Adam Maguire has the business for us.
Thanks very much. Amazon.com has posted a $126 million quarterly loss, which is much larger than had been expected. The company blames its rapid pace of investment in new businesses, such as digital content and consumer electronics. Amazon's stock price has dropped 10% so far this year, with investors leery of betting on its long-term growth at the expense of little to no profit. Revenue at Google's Irish subsidiary is 10% higher last year to €17 billion, with pre-tax profits up 23% to €189.1 million. Google Ireland's accounts show that administrative expenses at the subsidiary were €11.7 billion last year, which is 7.3% higher than in 2012. Those expenses largely refer to the royalties that Google's entities pay to places like Bermuda. Passenger figures at Shannon are 13% higher in the first 6 months of the year, according to the airport. Traffic for the first 3 weeks of July is also up 20%, according to the airport, with their chief executive, Neil Pakey, saying that the airport was well ahead of exceeding its targets. And an announcement of Ryanair's daily service from Shannon to Manchester and a weekly service from Canoes to Lithuania, they said that they helped to build towards a more balanced economy for Ireland. And on the currency markets, €1 buys you just over 79 pence sterling and $1.34.5.
Adam, thank you for that.
Fiona Kelly joins us with It Says in the Papers.
House prices provide the lead story in two of this morning's papers. Kenny denies bubble despite record surge in the price of homes is the lead headline in the Irish Independent, while the Irish Daily Mail runs with a headline which predicts that house prices will be back to boom levels by 2019. And though it doesn't run with the story on its front page, the Irish Times also covers the story today, focusing very much on the Dublin market, which has seen a 25% increase in house prices in the past year. And Conor Pope has done a price comparison which reflects that statistic on three roads in Stonybatter, Merino and Ranelagh. He's also penned an editorial piece under the headline, Worrying Sense of Deja Vu as Prices Surge. Back in The Independent, that expression deja vu also appears in a headline over a piece penned by David McWilliams, in which he talks about the psychology behind the property bubble, the herd mentality which drives it, and the number of cash buyers in the country who are fueling it. The lead editorial in today's Independent also addresses the Taoiseach's comments yesterday. The politician, Mr. Kenny, may welcome the short-term electoral benefits that will come this way if he continues to preside over a house price boom. The statesman should act now to halt an all-too-familiar scenario which could end up posing another death threat to our economy. The property bubble also gets mentioned in the other big domestic story this morning. The Irish Examiner and the Business Supplement in the Times both lead with comments made by Joachim Pfeiffer, an economics advisor to the German government, that there is no chance of us getting a deal on the bailout since the collapse was of Ireland's own making. It was your property bubble, he told a gathering at a German-Irish chamber lunch in Dublin yesterday. The Times leads today with the attack on a UN shelter in Gaza yesterday, which killed at least 15 civilians and wounded more than 200. Ruan McCormack reports from Jerusalem on the paper's front page today, while on an inside page, he reports from Ramallah on the Palestinian perspective. Elsewhere on the front page is The Times and Independent, both run with stories about how President Obama cited Ireland as a country which US companies relocate their headquarters to avail of favourable tax rates. Speaking of California, he described this kind of practice as an unpatriotic tax loophole. The Irish Sun leads with the line that the 62-year-old former judge, Heather Perrin, has been released from prison. The paper carries pictures of Mrs. Perrin, who received a 2.5-year sentence for deception in November 2012, walking near her home in Malahide yesterday, following her release from the Dochas prison on Wednesday. The Irish Daily Star and Herald both lead today with the tragic death of 13-year-old Gareth McGurk, who died while swimming in a reservoir in Drogheda yesterday afternoon. But finally, all of today's papers report on the news that Skellig Michael looks likely to be the location where a segment of the new Star Wars movie is shot next week. Although the story hasn't been officially confirmed, Boatman has spoken to the media about taking bookings to transport film crews out to the 6th century monastic site, which The Independent reports is being closed to the public for 3 days from next Monday. The Examiner, meanwhile, reports on how Killarney businessman Declan Mulvaney has been quick off the mark to capitalise on the film. Within minutes of hearing the news, he had produced a T-shirt, which is pictured in today's paper, which we're told is selling like hotcakes, which reads, Skellig Wars 2014.
Thank you, Fiona.
Well, let's start in West Africa and the Air Algérie tragedy. It was confirmed late last night that the wreckage of the plane has been found in Mali's Gossi region. It had been en route from Burkina Faso to Algeria. On board 116 people, a huge storm thought to be the cause of the crash. Fintan Ryan is a retired Aer Lingus captain. Good morning to you, Fintan.
Good morning. You also
worked as an engineer with Inmarsat, which works with satellites in terms of tracking planes and such like. You've undoubtedly been looking at this storm and the conditions surrounding the crash. Do we know what happened?
Well, we don't know what happened, but we have a situation where what is likely that the weather was involved. Now, when I heard that the aircraft had crashed, the first thing I did is I looked at the satellite images for the area, and I found there was a massive storm. That's in the intertropical convergence zone, which is an area of thunderstorms that moves north and south of the equator as seasons change. Also, I looked at the weather for the particular airport, Ouagadougou, and I found that they were forecasting thunderstorms there. At the time the aircraft took off, there was no thunderstorm there, but later on, for the next 2 or 3 hours, there were thunderstorms there. So the aircraft was flying into thunderstorms. The actual airport itself is in the middle of nowhere sort of thing, and they had a lot of systems out of service. For instance, there were four radio systems out of service. The radio navigation beacon at the airport was out of service. And the aircraft, I'm sure, was able to talk to the tower, but they would have taken off. They would have been totally aware of all these thunderstorms, and they would have had a weather radar. And the weather radar, they would use that to actually navigate its way through, like an obstacle course, between the very active thunderstorm cells and the less active ones. In other words, keeping to the quieter air. But unfortunately, it would seem that they were having difficulty communicating. And to actually change course, you actually had to clear that with air traffic control. And they were obviously having problems with that. So I feel myself that they might have gone left it a bit too late and ended up entering one of the really, really bad cells.
And is that request or that change in course an indication of just how bad that storm could have been?
No, it could be quite normal, actually, when you have thunderstorms, that to actually deviate a course right or left to get into quieter air, so to speak, and keep out of the icing and the very, very heavy rain and ice and hail that's associated with it. So it would be quite normal. But the problem is, in, let's say, in European or North American airspace, you have immediate contact with air traffic control. But there you have situations where the communications are very, very bad. It depends on HF, which is shortwave radio, extremely, an awful lot of interference and that sort of thing, and a huge delays in actually getting to the air traffic controller. For instance, you may have to relay through other stations. I think, right, in actual fact, he was talking to air traffic controllers in Niger, which is a different country altogether.
It's a bit of a hop. What about the plane in question?
Well, the aircraft is used to be called a DC-9. It's an MD-83 now. It's about 150 passengers. This particular one was 18 years old. It actually had 8 previous owners, but it would have been maintained in accordance with the requirements, and I don't think the actual age of the aircraft could have anything to do with it.
It's been an extraordinary week, hasn't it? An extraordinary 2 weeks in terms of the number of air tragedies we've had.
Yeah, well, we've had 3. There was another one down in the Far East, an aircraft landing down there after a typhoon that crashed. We had the MH17, which is, we still don't know the result of that, but I think, you know, they'll be able to tell from the damage to the aircraft what happened to it. I don't think the flight recorders will, or the voice recorders will be of great assistance, because I think it probably was a missile. As regards the one in Mali, I don't think it was a missile. The missiles there were SA-7s. They're only capable of shooting down aircraft when they're coming into land, that sort of thing.
And then part of the difficulty with the case in Ukraine is that the crash site has been contaminated effectively by people and even parts of the aircraft missing.
Well, you see, one of the things the investigators would be looking at would be the residues of the explosion, and they might actually be able to trace back the actual to a particular missile. All the stuff that was there may have been interfered with. In other words, there may have been really good evidence that was removed by people who knew that it might drop them in trouble. Mm. But the Mali one, of course, the voice recorder and the
the black box.
Will be of great assistance because, you know, if the aircraft broke up, it may have, or else it may have, the systems may have iced up and the instruments could have been wrong. The engines could have actually stopped because of the massive amount of water that was going into them, or it could have been disorientation because of the massive turbulence. But the recorders will be great use in the Mali accident.
And of course, in the case of Mali as well, the plane crash in Gossi. So getting there, getting teams there as well, quite a remote location.
Extremely remote. It's right in the middle of the Sahara Desert. And you hear about these places, but they're just little villages in the middle of nowhere and extremely, you know, no proper roads or anything like that. And you might look at the Sahara as a flat area, but in actual fact, it's very mountainous and extremely difficult terrain. And particularly as at the moment, there's lots of, because of the thunderstorm activity, there's lots of sandstorms. And so that makes it extremely difficult.
And huge conflict on the ground as well in Mali, which could pose problems.
Yes, well, the US issued a directive to its airlines not to fly over Mali below 24,000 feet. That's because they believe, I think myself normally, what they say is how far can these missiles go and multiply it by three. But the SA-7s wouldn't have been able to shoot down an aircraft up that high.
All right. Yeah. Fintan Ryan, thanks for coming in to us this morning. That's Fintan Ryan, retired Aer Lingus captain, also a former engineer with Inmarsat as well. So what we're going to do is move on now, the time being 20 minutes past 7. A lot of the discussion there this week was surrounding universal healthcare, and we've been talking about it all week, and it was an issue which was up for discussion at the McGill Summer School last night as well, as Lisa McKelvey now reports.
I am fairly sure before we start this work that there are only two ways to run a private health system and a public health system. One is to have them completely separate. There's a public health system over here, private health system over there, and they only meet by accident. And no one is allowed to work for both. Under any circumstances.
The other way is to completely integrate them. You're treating the same patients. You're in the same queues. You're getting paid the same.
Professor Anthony Staines of the School of Nursing and Human Sciences at Dublin City University, speaking at the McGill Summer School in Glenties in County Donegal last night. He outlined government plans for the introduction of universal health insurance by 2019.
Under the proposed UHI system, you'll be required to pay health insurance. This will cover you for primary care, for general practices, for drugs, and for hospital care. You will have to take it out. Depending on how much money you have, you'll either get all of your insurance paid, some of it paid, or none of it paid.
Addressing the summer school, Louise O'Donnell of the Health and Welfare Division of the Impact Trade Union raised questions about the plan.
And by far the biggest burden will fall on one third of the population, individuals and families who do not currently have private health insurance and who don't qualify for medical cards. It's safe to assume that most people in this category, which could be said to typify the so-called squeezed middle, simply cannot afford private health insurance, yet they will now be compelled by law to pay.
Dr. Anne-Marie Brady of the School of Nursing and Midwifery at Trinity College Dublin spoke of the pressing need for change within the current system.
Hospitals cost us a lot of money. We spend a lot of money on them, but they're not as effective or as efficient as they can be. We operate a two-tier hospital system where we disproportionately favour private patients over public.
The plan for UHI here is similar to a model which has already been implemented in the Netherlands. Impact's Louise O'Donnell said the Dutch model is not ideal.
The Dutch model, I suppose, is much better funded than the Irish model, but there's been a number of issues with it. Their fees are going up, the insurance they have to pay goes up year on year, yet the services they get are reducing, to the extent that 90% of Dutch people now have additional health insurance.
But what do the people think? Attendees at the summer school last night gave their views.
I pay private health insurance at the moment. I think a single tier system is what we need. It doesn't work. What we have at the moment just doesn't work at all.
I believe that the Dutch didn't get it right at the beginning and had to modify it and change it over time. A large number of my Dutch friends tell me they're not happy with the system. That said, it's certainly a better, more coherent, more effective programme than we have in Ireland. The only other thing I would say is that the Dutch are not the Irish.
There should be equality between the healthcare that people get, not that money talks and get people to get a better service just because they can have more money to get them that better service.
There was agreement at the McGill Summer School last night that a change is needed. Professor Anthony Staines summed up.
It will take time to get there. We will do it by piece by piece by piece. And we will get stuff wrong along the way, no question. But at least we're moving.
Professor Anthony Staines of DCU ending Lisa McKelvey's report from Glenties there. Let's go to Gaza, where the death toll continues to rise. More than 800 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces. The latest strike to kill was in Deir al-Balah. Amongst the dead there, a 23-year-old woman who was pregnant. Israel is pressing on with its 18-day offensive against the Strip in a bid, it says, to stamp out Gaza rocket fire. Yesterday alone, 100 people were killed in Gaza, and last night, two people also died during a protest in the West Bank city of Ramallah. On the Israeli side, 33 people have been killed, mainly soldiers. An attack yesterday at a United Nations shelter has come in for international condemnation. 15 people were killed when the Israeli Defence Forces hit the school in Beit Hanun. Robert Turner is head of the UN Relief and Works Agency, which runs the facility. We'll be speaking to him in a moment. First, though, let's hear Israeli government spokesperson Mark Regev, who told the BBC last night that the UN had been told to evacuate the school.
We've been warning people to leave that facility for 2-3 days now. We did it through the UN, we did it through the Red Cross, because we knew Hamas was exploiting that facility for its own terrorist machine. And we urge people to leave. There are reports that Hamas prevented people from leaving.
That is Mark Regev. Robert Turner of UNRWA is on the line. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning.
Mark Regev there saying people were prevented from leaving the building and the UN was warned. Do you know either to be the case?
Over the course of yesterday, we had been working, requesting a time period, a window during which we could withdraw our staff and give the displaced that chose to leave an opportunity to move because the security situation had deteriorated. We were never granted that window.
The Israeli Foreign Ministry is insisting that a window was put in place and was agreed.
That's simply inaccurate.
So what was the reality of what you were dealing with yesterday?
In Beit Hanun, generally that environment, the security situation had been deteriorating. To be clear, the Israeli forces have been telling everyone to leave everywhere within 3 kilometers of the boundary, with two exceptions, which are farther south. That's 40% of all of Gaza's area, and this school falls within that. We're not part of the Israeli information campaign. They had been passing these messages to everyone. It's up to the individuals to choose where they want to be. We respect their choice. But as I say, yesterday, we had decided that the situation was becoming too dangerous. We had requested a window during which it would be safe for our staff to withdraw. We were telling the displaced that we were leaving and why we were leaving. But that window was never granted.
Is there any possibility that a mistake was made here? Because UN facilities are quite clearly identifiable visually using blue paint and tend to be white walls with blue strips around them. And also the coordinates of such facilities would be made known. Do you believe there's any possibility a mistake was made?
But I think we need an investigation into what happened yesterday. But this is the fourth incident of strike directly on one of our schools in 4 days. We had an incident on Tuesday. Sorry, this has been going on too long. My days are getting mixed up. We had a strike on a school on Monday, on Tuesday, on Wednesday, and again yesterday. That's a trend. But we need an investigation. We need to understand exactly what happened in that school.
Who should conduct that investigation?
Well, the Israeli forces need to conduct that investigation. It needs to be transparent, and we need to understand the results.
You say it's part of a trend. Do you believe these to be deliberate pinpointings of certain facilities?
Well, I certainly hope not. I think it's more likely, I hope, that as you said, these are mistakes. Mistake is a strong term. I mean, somebody fired. And we need an investigation into what happened yesterday to determine. Certainly the three cases in the 3 days prior to that, our schools came under direct fire by Israeli forces. We need to understand why that happened, how that happened, and we need to understand what action is being taken so that that does not continue to happen.
What are your concerns now? You've this incident in Beit Hanoun yesterday. You have many other facilities all over the Gaza Strip in which people are turning up in their tens of thousands for shelter. How concerned are you about those other facilities?
Well, tremendously concerned. We have now about 150,000 people sheltering in our schools. That's more than 8% of the entire population is living in our schools, and they come to our schools because they feel safer there, because they're coming there as a refuge of last resort. The perception that's being created is that nowhere in Gaza is safe.
And is that the reality?
Unfortunately.
What about the international response? The Ban Ki-moon has been quite strong about this particular incident yesterday and others, but are you disappointed by the international response?
I think what we need is, and I know the Secretary General is working very hard on this, is we need a ceasefire, we need an end to the violence. And then following that, we need to address the root causes of what's going on here. We need to address the blockade, we need to address access to markets and freedom of movement. Obviously, Israel needs some form of guarantees for its security. But we need to move past the situation that we were in. We cannot go back to the way it was 4 weeks ago. It was an untenable situation.
What do you think the likelihood of peace or moving forward is when you see many member states of the European Union abstaining in a vote at which for an investigation into what's happening in the Gaza Strip at the moment? What sort of a signal do you think that sends out?
Well, I haven't seen the details of the resolution, but I think we do need a full investigation of all parties to the conflict.
All right. Robert Turner, head of the United Nations Relief and Works Agency in Gaza, thank you for speaking to us this morning.
Des Cahill joins us with sport. Morning, Des.
Good morning to you, Rachel. Well, I don't have great news, I'm afraid, from last night's soccer. We had four teams in European action and no great joy, really. Most of all, the women's under-19 team, the Irish team, out of the European Championships, losing their semi-final to the Netherlands 4-0 in Oslo, and the Dutch will now face Spain in the final. Ireland have already beaten Spain, but it's been a fantastic campaign and a top-four finish in Europe, a great achievement for the Irish girls. We'll be hearing from their manager later on. In the Europa League, Derry City, Dundalk and Sligo Rovers all bowed out, although Dundalk had a famous 2-1 victory away to Hajduk Split. Goals from Pat Hoban and Curtis Byrne gave Dundalk a 2-1 win in Croatia, but they were eliminated 3-2 in aggregate because of the home defeat. Derry lost 5-1 away to Shakhtar Soligorsk in Belarus. Michael Duffy scored an early goal for the Candy Stripes, but they go out 6-1 on aggregate. And for Sligo, there was absolute heartbreak because when Danny North scored first at the Showgrounds, they led Rosenborg 3-1 on aggregate. But the Norwegians came back to score three goals and win 4-3 on aggregate. Here's the Sligo manager, John Coleman.
We had to keep them out. We had to keep them down to one. And unfortunately, we weren't capable of doing that tonight. But I personally think that the key to the game was conceding the goal when we did. Because I think if we go in at half-time 1-0, I think there's only going to be one winner, because the space is going to be there for us to counter on them. And unfortunately, we give them a shot in the arm. We give them a shot of adrenaline. And that they give them the due, they took it with both hands. And, you know, good luck to them, and I hope they progress onto the group stages.
Well, as a result of the European games, there are just two matches tonight in the Premier Division. Cork City can go top clear by 3 points if they win at Bohemians, and Shamrock Rovers, they host Drogheda. In cycling, Vincenzo Nibali claimed his fourth stage success of this year's Tour de France and all but seals the overall victory. He stretched his lead to 7 minutes and 10 seconds with just 3 stages to go. On to Gaelic games, and ahead of Sunday's All-Ireland Hurling quarterfinals, both Limerick and Tipperary have named unchanged teams. We'll be looking ahead to the hurling later in the programme, but let's get a verdict on tomorrow's football now with Kevin McStay. Morning to you, Kevin.
Morning, Des.
Well, first game in the doubleheader in Tullamore is Cork against Sligo, and Cork are red-hot favourites despite poor form recently.
Yeah, they surely are odds on to win this. Sligo out at 7-1 with the bookies last night. They're the big outsiders. And if you look at the selections, Cork's selection reflects just what you said. Six changes, significant changes after the embarrassing defeat against Kerry. And Brian Cuthbert and some of the players suggesting they're playing for the reputation. I think they are, actually. I mean, it really was that poor against Tip. Sligo have gone off the same line-out that beat Limerick. I'm a little bit surprised about that, Des, because Stephen Coyne has been making very good contributions as a sub. David Kelly, once again, has an injury problem. He's been having that every time we preview a Sligo match this season. I think when you pair it all back, you know, Sligo are a mid-division three team, Cork, top four team for the last 5 or 6 years. And remember, they won the 2010 All-Ireland from the qualifiers, Des, so don't forget that either. If they perform, if Cork perform, and they haven't performed against Tip, they haven't performed against Kerry, but if they do perform, they'll win it by a handful of points. If they don't, they're in for a tough afternoon.
All right. And then Galway versus Tipperary, which is an intriguing game.
Well, it is, and the bookies can't separate them, and I don't think many of the pundits or punters can either. It's a massive game for both counties. I can't underline that enough. Like, if Tip were to get to a quarter-final place, Des, that would really, really frank the underage success and all their planning over the last few years. I was down at the Connacht final. I saw enough in Galway to say they have certainly potential, although they were very poor in the full back line and midfield, and that's the Tip are particularly strong. They scored 217 Tipperary have, and then 317 in their last two matches, so that's why they haven't changed their selection. Galway have absolutely turned around their selection, and the big news is they're putting in a new goalkeeper for his championship debut, so that's a big call. If Galway improve, if they were to show the potential that I believe they have, they might just win it. If they don't, Tipperary are going to win this. So that's why it's such an intriguing game, and I'll just by a slip give it to Galway.
All right, Kevin, thank you very much for joining us this morning. In golf, it's day two of the Russian Open underway. David Horsey leads on 7-under. Damien McGrain and Kevin Phelan are 3-under par. And Graham McDowell, 4 shots off the lead in the Canadian Open. He shot a 2-under par round of 68, including an eagle 2 on a par 4, a shot from 213 yards. Going into day two of the British Seniors Open in Wales, the leader is Bernhard Langer on 6-under. Philip Walton, Des Smith, best of the Irish on 1-over. Northern Ireland won its first medal at the Commonwealth Games in Glasgow when Lisa Carney from Belfast took bronze in judo. In racing, Jack Naylor was a surprise winner of the Group 3 Silver Flash Stakes at Leopardstown for Jessica Harrington and Fran Berry. Aidan and Joseph O'Brien teamed up to land the other Group 3 race, the Tyra Stakes, with the favourite Gleneagles. And we have 2 race meetings this evening at Wexford and Downroyal.
Des, thank you.
And Emma's here with business news now.
Thanks very much, Fran. As we heard earlier, the US President Barack Obama has been talking about Ireland and about tax, saying firms that come here for tax reasons are gaming the system. He said this kind of strategy undermines people's confidence in how companies are thinking about their responsibilities as a whole and hitting the heartstrings of corporate America. The president also said that people are also paid to be good corporate citizens, insinuating that those in business when dealing in inversion are not. We're joined now by Mark Murnan at ETEX Capital. Mark, it's pretty fair of the US president to say those companies are gaming the system, but maybe you could tell us what inversion is.
Basically, inversion is a move by a company to move their tax domicile to a country with a lower effective tax rate than where they are based. So they tend to do this through the takeover of a smaller company in the lower tax-based jurisdiction. So to put it in perspective, the U.S. Corporate tax rate is around 35%, Ireland's corporate tax rate 12.5%, and Britain, another country that is, you know, a focus of inversion-type deals, is 20%. So it's obviously very attractive for these large companies to move to somewhere with a lower tax rate. And we've seen a good number of examples recently.
You've seen quite a few, mostly pharmaceutical firms.
Yes, it's been very active in the pharmaceutical space. We saw the failed attempt by Pfizer to take over AstraZeneca. And then we saw the deal, which was on and off and on and off, between AbbVie, a U.S. pharmaceutical company, who are agreeing to take over Shire Pharmaceuticals, a FTSE 100 listed company. And basically, the gist of that deal is that AbbVie have quite a lot of cash, and they can acquire the Shire business. They can acquire the underlying business, but also by 2016, they can lower their effective tax rate to somewhere around 13 to 14%. So it's obviously very attractive for those companies to do these deals.
Do you think corporate America will listen to Barack Obama?
Well, the pressure is certainly ramping up. It has been, you know, discussed in the Senate, and you know there has been a lot of press and discussion about it. And this is obviously now President Obama choosing to speak on it, so it'll get an awful lot more global discussion, and you know the pressure is likely to continue to ramp up, and you know one can only speculate as to what's likely to happen, but certainly I'm sure there will be some extremely high level discussions about ways that the US government will try and stop this if it's possible going forward.
And changing subject, Mark, Amazon.com posted much bigger than expected loss in its second 3 months of its financial calendar. How come? How does the market read these results?
A dreadful set of numbers from Amazon. The second miss of the estimates for the second quarter in a row, and as a result the stock was severely punished in the after hours trading, stock down up to 10% at one stage after hours. The loss was more than double what the market expected, and basically what is happening is that the CEO, Jeff Bezos, is investing heavily in new businesses such as cloud computing, and he's investing in new warehouses to try and to speed up the distribution process. And it's certainly, you know, a lot of money going out, and he's not managing to balance the books, and the market is getting a little bit tired of seeing these losses.
He's also spending quite a lot of money on original video content that Amazon is thinking about, and also trying to rival Apple and Google and Netflix. What's ahead? Do you think the rest of the year will be better for Amazon?
Well, I think, you know, he has said in the last two conference calls that he's very happy with the way things are going, and he thinks that, you know, profits will come down the line. But, you know, it's strange, you know, that he would take a route of spending so much money, especially when he's not seeing the return up front. But, you know, I think shareholders will probably just have to stick with him and hope it's going to turn around.
Mark Manan of ETX Capital, thanks very much for joining us this morning. Some other business news in brief. Vodafone says it has not received any relief from tough market conditions in the first 3 months of its financial calendar, with a slowdown in Spain and South Africa resulting in another heavy drop in its key revenue measure. The world's second biggest mobile phone operator said the pace of decline in organic service revenue, which strips out items like handset sales and currency movements, accelerated to 4.2% in the 3 months to June. And British satellite television group BSkyB said it has agreed a multi-million dollar deal with Rupert Murdoch's media empire, 21st Century Fox, to create a pan-European pay TV giant. BSkyB has agreed to buy 21st Century Fox's 100% stake in Sky Italia and its 57.4% interest in Sky Deutschland.
Thank you very much, Emma.
When is a property bubble not a property bubble? Perhaps when the Central Statistics Office says house prices in the capital city have risen by 24% so far this year. Not so, says the Taoiseach. Enda Kenny was speaking yesterday.
No, I don't accept there's a bubble, but I do accept that prices are rising because of the law of supply and demand. And you can't sort this out unless you build new houses. And to build new houses, you've got to have a strategy, a combination of issues that can help that forward. For instance, we now know the extent of sites in the Greater Dublin area for which planning permission has been issued. Many of the contractors don't have the income line to actually develop those. We know the involvement of NAMA, for instance, in the Dublin Docklands, in making serious money available for wastewater treatment. In terms of house prices and the housing situation, between the categories of homelessness, as in people on the streets, families who are becoming homeless because of the rent position, at the end of the day, you're still going to have to build more houses.
That's Taoiseach Enda Kenny speaking at a news conference yesterday. Finance professor at Trinity College, Brian Lucy, is on the line. Good morning, Brian.
Morning.
Is the Taoiseach denying a reality?
Well, no, I think he's more realistic now than some of the government spokespeople have been over the last while. You know, technically this might not be a bubble because there are huge supply issues, as the Taoiseach has identified. Now, that means that when you've got very low supply and demand is rising, you'd expect to see prices rising. The thing is, though, that when you see a 25% year-on-year rise in house prices, that should absolutely terrify people. High house prices are not good for the economy. If we have learned nothing, and apparently we have learned nothing, then, you know, there's really no hope.
If you say that the 25% year-on-year rise should terrify people, what should it do to an administration, to a government?
Well, I presume it should terrify them as well, and it should spur them into pretty immediate action to, you know, try and advance the things that can be advanced quickly. Look, we've known since 1970 44 years that there is problems with land bank hoarding. We've done nothing about it. Why would we expect that simply because we're into another bubble, government and administration would stir themselves? We've known that there are problems with SMEs getting finance for the last 5 or 6 years, and most of the developers are not the big billion-dollar people. They're people building 20, 30, 50 houses, SMEs by any definition. We've known that there are problems for 18 months with zoned land not being serviced because the local authorities don't have the money to engage in putting in the sewerage lines, etc. Nothing has been done on that.
Do you get the sense, though, now that it could that could be changing?
I think that this is beginning to change, but these things take a very long time. You know, there's ideas of building, you know, 5, 10, 15,000 houses, and that's great. That's next year, and that'll help. We have a very thin market. The market could very easily collapse out under it as the cash buyers disappear, which would result in a double dip. Let's remember, if you go back to, you know, this pretty seminal work of Morgan Kelly, you know, who is the man that we really ought to take very seriously, the man who took the scales from all of our eyes. His original 2007 ESRI data analysis, which nobody has been able to disclaim, suggested that we should be looking at about a 65% fall in house prices. We're recovering, and we're now at about a 40% fall. House prices are not affordable in Ireland. They might be affordable in the southwest. They might be affordable in the upper Shannon Basin. They're not affordable in Dublin. And there's a big problem here.
In a word, Brian Lucey, for people who are looking at the property market and aren't yet in it as yet, and in a word, there's a headline on the front of the Daily Mail, house prices back to boom levels by 2019. Are we going there?
I think we run a danger. You know, but that kind of, those kind of headlines, you know, I don't know if the Mail are being their usual, you know, pop self or not, but we don't want to go back there. We want to get house prices down to a sustainable level. At a €35,000 average income, which is what it is in the country, if you do the math of three times one salary and, you know, once the next salary and at 80 or 85% loan-to-value ratio, we should be looking at average house prices around the €200,000 area.
Right.
That will be up and down according to different regions. But when you've got it well above that, which we have, when you have international property valuers saying that we're overpriced, when you see the vulture funds and you know, value funds and bottom feeding funds that we've seen come in and pick up the good stuff and are now leaving, they're saying the market's, if not toppy, on the rise. This is about as big a flare lit tip off that we have a major problem as we can ever get.
All right, just
the danger is in the middle of July. It'll be October before anything gets done.
Just very briefly, Brian Lucey, speculation yesterday and commentary yesterday from a German MEP, a senior advisor to Angela Merkel, that there's no hope of a deal on the €64 billion banking bailout. Should we be surprised?
No. I mean, every single commentator has been saying that there was never a hope of this. The government have been peddling the argument that this was a game changer. It was never going to work. You cannot on one hand say to people, we're doing great, and the other hand say, give us a handout. You know, we were never going to get this money. Okay. And it was fallacious to believe so, and it was disingenuous to claim so.
All right. Brian Lucey, Professor of Finance at Trinity College. Thanks for taking our call this morning.
The weekend weather forecast next from Clara Finkela at Met Aaron.
Thank you and good morning from it, Aaron. There's quite a bit of mist or fog this morning, mainly over the western half of the country, but that soon will lift and today will be dry and sunny in most areas. However, scattered showers will develop over the west during the afternoon and evening, with some heavy or thundery downpours most likely in the southwest. Continuing very warm and humid, with top temperatures reaching again 22 to 27 degrees and light southeast or variable winds. Tonight will become cloudy with showery outbreaks of rain over the west and northwest, turning heavy and persistent with the risk of thundery downpours, which could lead to localized flooding. The showery rain will spread further eastwards later in the night, but parts of the southeast will stay mostly dry until dawn. Mild and humid with lowest temperatures between 14 and 16 degrees and light variable winds, which will become west to northwest by morning. during Saturday morning showery outbreaks of rain will spread further eastwards and become persistent or heavy in the north and northeast for a time. A clearance will follow from the west with fresher and drier weather, and the northwesterly winds will increase moderate and occasionally fresh in the north. Top temperatures will return to more normal values for the time of the year and reach between 18 and 22 degrees, coolest in the north. There will be scattered showers on Sunday with some sunny spells, but it will stay cloudier in the north with showery rain turning heavier persistent. It will be cooler and fresher day with top temperatures between 17 and 21 degrees, and the northwesterly winds will increase moderate to fresh. And the early days of next week will be mostly dry with isolated showers and some hazy sunshine. It will become humid again, but top temperatures will stay in the high teens to low 20s. And to recap, mostly dry with thundery showers in the west, very warm with top temperatures again of 22 to 27 degrees. And that's the forecast. A very good morning to you.